This is Audible.
Penguin Random House Audio presents From Strength to Strength, Finding Success, Happiness, and Deep Purpose in the Second Half of Life. This is the author, Arthur C. Brooks. To my guru. Blessed are those whose strength is in you, whose hearts are set on pilgrimage. As they pass through the Valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs. The autumn rains also cover it with pools. They go from strength to strength, till each appears before God in Zion. Psalm 84, 5-7. Introduction. The man on the plane who changed my life. It's not true that no one needs you anymore. These exasperated words came from an elderly woman sitting behind me on a late-night flight from Los Angeles to Washington, D.C. The plane was dark and quiet, and most people were either sleeping or watching a movie. I was working on my laptop, feverishly trying to finish something now completely lost to memory, but that, at the time, seemed to be of crucial importance to my life, happiness, and future. A man I assumed to be her husband murmured almost inaudibly in response. Again, his wife, "Oh, stop saying it would be better if you were dead." Now they had my full attention. I didn't mean to eavesdrop, but I couldn't help it. I listened half with human empathy and half with the professional fascination of a social scientist. I formed an image of the husband in my head. I imagined someone who had worked hard all his life in relative obscurity. Someone disappointed at his dreams unfulfilled, perhaps the career he never pursued, the schools he never attended, the company he never started. Now, I imagined, he was forced to retire, tossed aside like yesterday's news. As the lights switched on after touchdown, I finally got a look at the desolate man. I was shocked. I recognized him. He was well-known, famous even. Then, in his mid-80s, he had been universally beloved as a hero for his courage, patriotism, and accomplishments of many decades ago. I have admired him since I was young. As he passed up the aisle of the plane behind me, passengers recognized him and murmured with veneration. Standing at the door of the cockpit, the pilot recognized him and said, echoing my own thoughts, "Sir, I have admired you since I was a little boy." The older man, apparently wishing for death just a few minutes earlier, beamed at the recognition of his past glories. I wondered, which more accurately describes the man? The one filled with joy and pride right now, or the one 20 minutes ago, telling his wife he might as well be dead? I couldn't get the cognitive dissonance of that scene out of my mind over the following weeks. It was the summer of 2012. Shortly after my 48th birthday. I was not world famous like the man on the plane, but my professional life was going pretty well. I was the president of a prominent Washington, D.C. think tank that was prospering. I had written some best-selling books. People came to my speeches. My columns were published in the New York Times. I had found a list written on my 40th birthday, 8 years earlier, of my professional goals, those that, if accomplished, would, I was sure, bring me satisfaction. I had met or exceeded all of them, and yet I wasn't particularly satisfied or happy. I had gotten my heart's desire, at least as I imagined it, but it didn't bring me the joy I envisioned. And even if it did deliver satisfaction, could I really keep this going? If I stayed at it 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, which basically I did with my 80-hour work weeks, at some point, my progress would slow and stop. Many days I was thinking this slowing had already started. And what then? Would I wind up looking back on my life and telling my long-suffering wife, Esther, that I might as well be dead? Was there any way to get off the hamster wheel of success and accept inevitable professional decline with grace? Maybe even turn it into opportunity? Though these questions were personal, I decided to approach them as the social scientist that I am, treating them as a research project. It felt unnatural, like a surgeon taking out his own appendix. I plunged ahead, however, and for the last 9 years, I have been on a personal quest to turn my future from a matter of dread into an opportunity for progress. I delved into divergent literatures, from my own field in social science to adjacent work in brain science, philosophy, theology, and history. I dug into the biographies of some of the most successful people in history. I immersed myself in the research on people who strive for excellence and interviewed hundreds of leaders, from heads of state to hardware store owners. What I found was a hidden source of anguish that wasn't just widespread, but nearly universal among people who have done well in their careers. I came to call this the striver's curse. People who strive to be excellent at what they do often wind up finding their inevitable decline terrifying, their successes increasingly unsatisfying, and their relationships lacking. The good news is that I also discovered what I was looking for, a way to escape the curse. Methodically, I built a strategic plan for the rest of my life, giving me the chance to have a second half of adulthood that is not only not disappointing, but happier and more meaningful than the first. But I quickly realized that creating a private life plan wasn't good enough. I had to share it. The secrets I found were available to anyone with a will to live a life of joy and purpose, and willing to do the work to achieve it. Unlike the world we have tried to conquer earlier in life, here there was no competition for the prizes. We can all succeed and all be happier. And that is why I have written this book for you, my fellow striver. The fact that you picked up this book tells me that you have most likely achieved success through hard work, huge sacrifice, and uncompromising excellence. And let's be honest, probably no small amount of good luck, too. You deserve a lot of praise and admiration, and you've probably gotten it. But you know intellectually you can't keep this party going forever, and you might even already see the signs that it's coming to an end. Unfortunately, you never gave much thought to the party's end, so you only have one strategy. Try to keep it going. Deny change and work harder. But that is a sure path to misery. In my field of economics, we have something called Stein's Law, named after the famous economist Herbert Stein from the 1970s. If something cannot go on forever, it will stop. Obvious, right? Well, when it comes to their own lives, people ignore it all the time. But you ignore this about your professional success at your peril. It will leave you falling further and further behind, shaking your fist at the heavens. There is another path, though. Instead of denying change in your abilities, you can make the change itself a source of strength. Instead of trying to avoid decline, you can transcend it by finding a new kind of success, better than what the world promises, and not a source of neurosis and addiction, a deeper form of happiness than what you had before. And in the process, true meaning in life, maybe for the first time. The process is what I lay out in this book. It has changed my life. And it can change yours, too. A word of caution, though. This path means going against many of your striverly instincts. I'm going to ask you not to deny your weaknesses, but rather to embrace them defenselessly. To let go of some things in your life that you worked hard for, but that are now holding you back. To adopt parts of life that will make you happy, even if they don't make you special. To face decline and even death with courage and confidence, to rebuild the relationships you neglected on the long road to worldly success, and to dive into the uncertainty of a transition you have worked so hard to evade. None of this is easy. It's hard to teach an old striver new tricks. It takes great effort to accept ideas that might have seemed crazy when you were doing everything under your power to be truly great at your worldly vocation. But I promise you, the payoff will be worth it. I, and you, can get happier every year. We can go from strength to strength. Chapter 1. Your professional decline is coming much sooner than you think. Who are the five greatest scientists who ever lived? This is the kind of question people like to debate in nerdy corners of the internet that you probably don't visit, and I don't intend to take you there. But no matter how much or little you know about science, your list is sure to contain Charles Darwin. He's remembered today as a man who changed our understanding of biology completely and permanently. So profound was his influence that his celebrity has never wavered since his death in 1882. And yet, Darwin died considering his career to be a disappointment. Let's back up. Darwin's parents wanted him to be a clergyman, a career for which he had little enthusiasm or aptitude. As such, he was a lackluster student. His true love was science, which made him feel happy and alive. So it was the opportunity of a lifetime for him. "By far the most important event in my life," he later called it, when, in 1831, at age 22, he was invited to join the voyage of the Beagle, a scientific sailing investigation around the world. For the next 5 years aboard the ship, he collected exotic plant and animal samples, sending them back to England to the fascination of scientists and the general public. This was impressive enough to make him pretty well known. When he returned home at age 27, however, he started an intellectual fire with his theory of natural selection, the idea that over generations, species change and adapt, giving us the multiplicity of plants and animals we see after hundreds of millions of years. Over the next 30 years, he developed his theory and published it in books and essays, his reputation growing steadily. In 1859, at age 50, he published his magnum opus and crowning achievement, On the Origin of Species, a bestseller explaining his theory of evolution that made him into a household name and changed science forever. At this point, however, Darwin's work stagnated creatively. He hit a wall in his research and couldn't make new breakthroughs. Around that time, a Czech monk by the name of Gregor Mendel discovered what Darwin needed to continue his work, the theory of genetics. Unfortunately, Mendel's work was published in an obscure German academic journal, and Darwin never saw it. And in any case, Darwin, who, remember, had been an unmotivated student, did not have the mathematical or language skills to understand it. Despite his writing numerous books later in life, his work, after that, broke little ground. In his last years, Darwin was still very famous. Indeed, after his death, he was buried as a national hero in Westminster Abbey. But he was increasingly unhappy about his life, seeing his work as unsatisfying, unsatisfactory, and unoriginal. "I have not the heart or strength at my age to begin any investigations lasting years, which is the only thing which I enjoy," he confessed to a friend. "I have everything to make me happy and contented, but life has become very wearisome to me." Darwin was successful by the world's standards, washed up by his own. He knew that by all worldly rights, he had everything to make him happy and contented, but confessed that his fame and fortune were now like eating straw. Only progress and new successes, such as he enjoyed in his past work, could cheer him up. And this was now beyond his abilities. So he was consigned to unhappiness in his decline. Darwin's melancholy did not abate, by all accounts, before he died at 73. I'd like to be able to tell you that Darwin's decline and unhappiness in old age were as rare as his achievements, but that's not true. In fact, Darwin's decline was completely normal and right on schedule. And if you, like Darwin, have worked hard to be exceptional at what you do, you will almost certainly face a similar pattern of decline and disappointment, and it will come much, much sooner than you think. The surprising earliness of decline. Unless you follow the James Dean formula, live fast, die young, leave a good-looking corpse, you know that your professional, physical, and mental decline is inevitable. You probably just think it's a long, long way off. You're not alone in thinking this. For most people, the implicit belief is that aging and its effect on professional performance are something that happened far in the future. This attitude explains all kinds of funny survey results. For example, when asked in 2009 what being old means, the most popular response among Americans was turning 85. In other words, the average American, who lives to 79, dies 6 years before entering old age. Here's the reality. In practically every high-skill profession, decline sets in sometime between one's late 30s and early 50s. Sorry, I know that stings. And it gets worse. The more accomplished one is at the peak of one's career, the more pronounced decline seems once it is set in. Obviously, you aren't just going to take my word for this, so let's take a look at the evidence. We'll start with the most obvious and earliest decline. Athletes. Those playing sports requiring explosive power or sprinting see peak performance from 20 to 27 years of age, while those playing endurance sports peak a bit later, but still as young adults. No surprise there. No one expects a serious athlete to remain competitive until age 60, and most of the athletes I talked to for this book, there aren't any surveys asking when people expect to experience their physical decline, so I started doing so informally, figured they would have to find a new line of work by the time they were 30. They don't love this reality, but they generally face it. It's a much different story for what I now call knowledge workers. Most people reading this book, I would guess. Among people in professions requiring ideas and intellect rather than athletic skill and significant physical strength, almost no one admits expecting to decline before their 70s, some later than that. Unlike athletes, however, they are not facing reality. Take scientists. Benjamin Jones, a professor of strategy and entrepreneurship at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, has spent years studying when people are most likely to make prize-winning scientific discoveries and key inventions. Looking at major inventors and Nobel winners going back more than a century, Jones finds that the most common age for a great discovery is one's late 30s. He shows that the likelihood of a major discovery increases steadily through one's 20s and 30s and then declines dramatically through one's 40s, 50s, and 60s. There are outliers, of course, but the probability of producing a major innovation at age 70 is approximately equal to what it was at age 20, about zero. That fact, no doubt, inspired Paul Dirac, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist, to pen a little melancholy verse about how age is every physicist's curse. It ends with these two lines: "He is better dead than living still when once he is past his 30th year." Dirac won the prize when he was 31 years old for work he had done in his mid-20s. By his 30th birthday, he had developed a general theory of the quantum field, the area in which he had earned his PhD at Cambridge at age 24. At 28, he wrote The Principles of Quantum Mechanics, a textbook still in use today. At 30, he was a chaired professor at Cambridge. And after that, he was an active scholar and made a few breakthroughs. But it was nothing like the early years, hence his poem. Of course, Nobel winners might be different than ordinary scientists. Jones, with a co-author, dug deeper into the data on researchers in physics, chemistry, and medicine who had highly cited work, as well as patents and various prizes. They found that peak performance is occurring at later ages than in the past, principally because the knowledge required to do cutting-edge work has increased so much over the decades. Still, since 1985, the peak age is not old. For physicists, 50. For chemistry, 46. And for medicine, 45. After that, innovation drops precipitously. Other knowledge fields follow the same basic pattern. For writers, decline sets in between about 40 and 55. Financial professionals reach peak performance between the ages of 36 and 40. Or take doctors. They appear to peak in their 30s, with steep drop-offs in skill as the years pass. It's sort of reassuring to have a doctor who reminds people my age of Marcus Welby, MD. However, one recent Canadian study looked at 80% of the country's anesthesiologists and patient litigation against them over a 10-year period. The researchers found that physicians over 65 are 50% more likely than younger doctors, under 51, at being found at fault for malpractice. Entrepreneurs are an interesting case when it comes to peak age. Tech founders often earn vast fame and fortune in their 20s, but many are in creative decline by age 30. The Harvard Business Review has reported that founders of enterprises backed with $1 billion or more in venture capital tend to cluster in the 20 to 34 age range. The number of founders older than this, they discovered, is low. Other scholars dispute this finding, claiming that the average age of the founders of the highest growth startups is, in fact, 45. But the point remains the same. By middle age, entrepreneurial ability is plummeting. Even by the most optimistic estimates, only about 5% of founders are over 60. The pattern isn't limited to knowledge work. Noticeable age-related decline comes earlier than people think in skilled jobs from policing to nursing. Peak performance is 35 to 44 for equipment service engineers and office workers. It's 45 to 54 for semi-skilled assembly workers and mail sorters. The age-related decline among air traffic controllers is so sharp, and the consequences of decline-related errors so dire, that the mandatory retirement age is 56. Decline is so predictable that one scholar has built an eerily accurate model to predict it in specific professions. Dean Keith Simonton from the University of California, Davis, studied the pattern of professional decline among people in creative professions and built a model that estimates the shape of the average person's career. Fitting curves to gigabytes of data, he found that the peak of creative careers occurs at about 20 years after career inception, hence the finding that people usually start declining somewhere between 35 and 50. This is averaged across lots of fields, however, and Simonton found a fair amount of variation. For example, he's looked at the half-life of many professions, the age at which half of one's work has been produced. That would more or less correspond on average with the highest point in the curve, roughly halfway through the years after starting one's career. A group that closely tracks this 20-year half-life is novelists, who generally do half their work before and half after 20.4 years from the start of their writing careers. Also close to this are mathematicians, who have a half-life of 21.7 years. Slightly earlier are poets, who hit their half-life after 15.4 years. Slightly later are geologists, at 28.9 years. Let's think what this means for a moment. Say you are involved in a quantitative field. You're a data analyst, for example. If you finish your education and start your career at 22, you will, on average, hit your professional peak at 44 and then start to see your skills decline. Now say you're a poet, freshly minted with a Master of Fine Arts degree at age 25. Simonton's data show that you will burn through half your life's work by about age 40 and be in productivity decline after that. On the other hand, if you're a geologist, your peak will tend to come closer to 54. For me, early decline is personal. When I started this research, I was especially keen to see if the decline patterns applied to musicians, especially classical musicians. There are some famous cases of classical musicians who go on and on performing into old age. In 1945, double bass player Jane Little joined the Atlanta Symphony at the tender age of 16. She retired 71 years later at the age of 87. Well, she didn't exactly retire. She actually died on stage during a concert while performing There's No Business Like Show Business. Ms. Little is not the norm, however. Most retire much earlier. And arguably, retirement happens too late. In surveys, classical musicians report that peak performance occurs in one's 30s. Younger players often groan over the prime spots occupied by older players with tenure. Orchestras have tenure just like universities, who hang around long after they've lost their edge. The problem is, these older players often can't admit decline, even to themselves. "It's very hard to admit that it's time," said one 58-year-old French horn player in the Pittsburgh Symphony Orchestra. "We're expert at denial. We have been successful because we refuse to accept the overwhelming odds at making it in our profession. So early in our development, denial is a positive." That French horn player wasn't me, but it could have been in a parallel life. As a child, in fact, I had just one goal, to be the world's greatest French horn player. I practiced my horn slavishly, hours and hours a day, playing in any ensemble I could find. I had pictures of famous horn players on my bedroom wall for inspiration. I went to all the best music festivals and studied with the greatest teachers available to a lower middle class kid in Seattle. I was always the best player, the first chair. For a while, I thought my young life's dream might come true. At 19, I left college to take a job playing professionally in a touring chamber music ensemble. We played 100 concerts a year, driving around the country in an oversized van. I didn't have health insurance, and rent day was always nerve-wracking. But by the age of 21, I had seen all 50 states and 15 foreign countries and made albums that occasionally I would hear on the radio. My dream was to rise through the classical music ranks in my 20s, join a top symphony orchestra in a few years, and then become a soloist, the most exalted job a classical musician can hold. But then, in my early 20s, a strange thing happened. I started getting worse. To this day, I have no idea why. My technique began to suffer, and I had no explanation for it. Nothing helped. I visited famous teachers and practiced more, but I couldn't get back to where I had been. Pieces that had been easy to play became hard. Pieces that had been hard became impossible. Perhaps the worst moment in my young but flailing career was at Carnegie Hall in New York City. While delivering a short speech about the music I was about to play, I stepped forward, lost my footing, and fell off the stage into the audience. On the way home from the concert, I mused darkly that the experience was surely a message from God. Whether from God or not, I didn't listen to that message. I had no concept of myself apart from great French horn player. I would rather have died than given up. I sputtered along for 9 more years. At 25, I took a position in the City Orchestra of Barcelona, where I increased my practicing, but my playing continued to deteriorate. After a few years, I found a job teaching at a small music conservatory in Florida, hoping for a magical turnaround that never materialized. Realizing that maybe I ought to hedge my bets, without telling a soul but my wife, I felt ashamed. I went back to college via distance learning. I never met a professor or set foot in a classroom and earned my bachelor's degree in economics a month before my 30th birthday. For me, graduation day meant walking out to the mailbox in my slippers to pick up my diploma. On the envelope was prominently written, "Do not fold." It was folded. I secretly continued my studies at night, earning a master's degree in economics a year later. I kept up my practicing and continued to make my living as a musician all the while, hoping against hope that I'd see a comeback in my skills. It didn't happen. And so, at age 31, I admitted defeat. I was never going to turn around my faltering music career. But what else to do with my life? I reluctantly went into the family business. My father was an academic. His father was an academic. I abandoned my musical aspirations and started a PhD. Life goes on, right? Sort of. After finishing my studies, I became a university professor, engaged in social science research and teaching, work I enjoyed a lot. But I still thought every day about my beloved first and true vocation. Even now, I regularly dream that I'm on stage. I can hear the orchestra and see the audience. I'm in the zone of blissful musical flow, playing better than ever. And I wake to remember that my childhood aspirations are now only phantasms. In truth, I'm lucky. I now know that my decline was coming, and I just got it a decade or two earlier than is ordinarily the case. As such, I was able to accommodate it early enough that I could redirect my life into a new line of intellectual work. Still, to this day, the sting of that early decline makes these words difficult to say. I vowed to myself that it wouldn't ever happen to me again. But of course, the data don't lie. It will happen again. Why we decline and how it affects us. For most people, decline is not just an unwelcome surprise. It is also a huge mystery. We learn early on that practice makes perfect. There is plenty of research telling us that mastery comes from 10,000 hours of work or some really high number like that. In other words, life has a formula. The more you do something, the better at it you become. But then you don't. Progress isn't a straight line upward, as Simonton's model showed. So what explains the downward portion? One early theory was that intelligence decreases with age. Researchers compared raw cognitive ability, IQ, across people of all ages and consistently found that young people do much better than older people. This led to the view that IQ falls as we age, and thus our abilities decline as well. However, this analysis was fundamentally flawed. It compared better-educated people, who are generally younger, with those who grew up with fewer educational opportunities. Looking at individuals over time, researchers find that intelligence decreases are much less pronounced than the older studies showed. A better explanation involves structural changes in the brain, specifically the changing performance of the prefrontal cortex, the part of the brain behind your forehead. This is the last part of the brain to develop in childhood and the first to exhibit decline in adulthood. It is primarily responsible for working memory, executive function, and inhibitory mechanisms, that is, the ability to block out information extraneous to the task at hand so we can focus and improve in our core skill. A big, strong prefrontal cortex makes it possible for you to get better and better at your specialty, whether it's making a legal case, doing surgery, or driving a bus. In middle age, the prefrontal cortex degrades in effectiveness, and this has several implications. The first is that rapid analysis and creative innovation will suffer, just what we would expect when looking at the evidence on decline. The second is that some specific, once easy skills become devilishly hard, like multitasking. Older people are much more easily distracted than younger people. If you have, or had, teenage kids, you might have found yourself telling them that they can't study effectively while listening to music and texting their friends. Actually, it's you who can't do that. In fact, older adults can enhance their cognitive effectiveness precisely by taking their own advice. Turn off the phone and music and go someplace completely quiet to think and work. Another skill is the recall of names and facts. By the time you're 50, your brain is as crowded with information as the New York Public Library. Meanwhile, your personal research librarian is creaky, slow, and easily distracted. When you send him to get some information you need, say someone's name, he takes a minute to stand up, stops for coffee, talks to an old friend in the periodicals, and then forgets where he was going in the first place. Meanwhile, you are kicking yourself for forgetting something you've known for years. When the librarian finally shows back up and says, "That guy's name is Mike," Mike is long gone, and you're doing something else. Despite the annoyances, some people deal with decline fairly well. Take the case of Paul Dirac, the Nobel-winning physicist who wrote that sad little poem about physicists being washed up by age 30. His most important work and most intensely productive years were indeed in his 20s and early 30s. After his mid-30s, he was still an active scholar and did some good work, but not like before. He made the best of it, though. In what can only be regarded as a work of late-in-life genius, at 70, Dirac left dreary Cambridge and accepted a professorship at Florida State University. He spent his later years taking in the sun and swimming. At FSU, each day he would eat lunch with colleagues and then take a nap. He did continue to publish papers, without any dramatic results. His last paper deals with a research question he was never able to answer and ends with these honest words: "I have spent many years searching and have not yet found it. I shall continue to work on it as long as I can, and other people, I hope, will follow along such lines." Unfortunately, his equanimity is the exception to the rule. Take the case of Linus Pauling, the only individual to win two different Nobel Prizes in distinct fields. Like Dirac and so many others, his greatest insights came in his 20s. In his 30s, he wrote his most famous book, The Nature of the Chemical Bond, which summarized his work from the previous decade. He won the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1954 for his work on chemical bonds, which he had done decades earlier. Pauling continued to do research in science after his great discoveries, but began to spend more time on public activism in, some believe, an effort to stay in the limelight. After World War II, Pauling turned his attention to anti-nuclear crusading. As a Nobel-winning chemist and contemporary of the scientists who developed the atomic bomb, the anti-war movement in the United States and Europe elevated him to a position of major prominence. Pauling was awarded a Nobel Peace Prize in 1962 for his work to abolish nuclear testing during the height of the Cold War. For obvious reasons, this made him a controversial political figure. To some, he was a hero. To others, a scoundrel. The latter group highlighted the fact that he also won, and accepted, the Lenin Peace Prize from the Soviet Union in 1970. Pauling's hunger for relevance then led him to promote faddish, quasi-scientific ideas. He promoted eugenics, believing that people with certain genetic conditions, such as sickle cell disease, should be prominently tattooed as a warning to potential mates. More famously, he became obsessed with his own theory that vitamins could cure a host of diseases, even cancer, and massively extend life. He promoted what he called orthomolecular psychiatry to treat mentally ill patients with massive doses of vitamins. Most likely, you've been told that high doses of vitamin C can prevent colds. This theory comes from Pauling's famous writings from the 1970s, which have been scientifically debunked many times, as were virtually all of his later ideas. Indeed, as Cambridge professor Stephen Cave documents, Pauling came to be known as something of a quack in mainstream medical circles and spent a good deal of the last decades of his life bitterly denouncing his many critics in science journals. The agony of irrelevance. I have no doubt that what made decline so hard for Pauling was that as his abilities declined, so did his relevance to the public. And whether we are famous or not, almost nothing feels worse than becoming irrelevant, or even useless, to others who once held us in esteem. I have heard this lament again and again as I did research for this book. For example, I talked to a rare book dealer in New York. He loved his profession and enjoyed his career, but now, well, I'll let him speak for himself. I've been a rare book dealer for my entire life, in business by 24. I've been blessed. Bob Dylan, John Updike, J.M. Coetzee, Woodward and Bernstein, endless estates, Waugh, Pound, Churchill, Roosevelt. 20 years ago at a dinner party, folks would hang on what I had to say. Anecdotes of travel in search of textual treasures, deal-making. But over the last dozen years, I've seen myself through the eyes of people across the table. What do they see? I guess I'd have to say, yesterday. I spoke to a 50-year-old woman working in a high-responsibility administrative post at a major university. If they ever refine software enough to reduce human error to the point where human eyeballs are no longer needed to double-check the work, I'm out of a job. I figure I've got about 5 to 10 years left. I do try to hide my decline, for the time being, while I'm at work, even though I know I can't hide it forever. I want time enough to make changes without losing my income. But if I get fired one day, oh well, life goes on, or it doesn't. Or consider this from a prominent female journalist in her 50s. Many days, I lack motivation to dive into another 10 hours of very hard work. The cost of lost sleep or too much travel takes a toll on our bodies. We used to rebound quickly. Not anymore. The true decline happened a lot to my colleagues in their 40s. From my outsider's view, it looked like weariness had set in. Trudging out the door to another city council meeting, highway crash, murder, tax story, all the things they had done 100 times over the years. They were tired. In 2007, a team of academic researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, and Princeton University analyzed data on more than 1,000 elderly people. Their findings, published in the Journal of Gerontology, showed that senior citizens who never or rarely felt useful were nearly 3 times as likely as those who frequently felt useful to develop a mild disability, and more than 3 times as likely to have died during the course of the study. You might reply that memories of past relevance should be enough for us. That is a common assumption people make as they try to accumulate a lot of money, power, and prestige. They think they can make it once and for all. Life is a treasure hunt, this thinking goes. Go out and find the pot of gold, and then you can enjoy it and be happy for the rest of your life, even after your glory days are past. Go get rich and retire early. Go get famous and bask in the experience after it is past. In my profession, go earn tenure and you will be all set. Then, when the success wanes, you can enjoy the memory of what you accomplished. By this standard, the man on the plane I wrote about in the introduction should have been the happiest guy in the world. He was rich, famous, and respected for what he had done long ago. He had won the race. The same goes for Darwin and Pauling. But they weren't happy because that model is all wrong. It is based on a completely misbegotten model of human striving. In fact, had the man on the plane had an ordinary life, had he never accomplished something extraordinary, he might not have felt so miserably irrelevant today. We might call this the principle of psychoprofessional gravitation, the idea that the agony of decline is directly related to prestige previously achieved and to one's emotional attachment to that prestige. If you have low expectations and never do much, or do a lot but maintain a Buddha-like level of non-attachment to your professional prestige, you probably won't suffer much when you decline. But if you attain excellence and you are deeply invested in it, you can feel pretty irrelevant when you inevitably fall from those heights. And that is agony. Great gifts and achievements early in life are simply not an insurance policy against suffering later on. On the contrary, studies show that people who have chased power and achievement in their professional lives tend to be unhappier after retirement than people who did not. Even simply being identified early on as gifted can lead to problems, according to Carol and Charles Holohan, psychologists at the University of Texas at Austin. They looked at hundreds of elderly people who had been publicly identified as highly gifted early in life. The Holohan's conclusion? Learning at a younger age of membership in a study of intellectual giftedness was related to less favorable psychological well-being at age 80. The Holohan study may simply be showing that it's hard to live up to high expectations and that telling your kid she's a genius is pretty bad parenting. However, there's also evidence that high accomplishment affects people negatively when it finishes. Consider the case of professional athletes, many of whom struggle greatly after leaving their sports careers. Tragic examples abound, involving addiction or suicide. Unhappiness in retired athletes may even be the norm, at least temporarily. I asked 1996 Olympic gold medal gymnast Dominique Dawes about how life feels after competing and winning at the highest levels. She told me she enjoyed her normal life, but the adjustment wasn't easy, and still isn't. My Olympic self will ruin my marriage and leave my kids feeling inadequate, she told me bluntly. Living life as if every day is an Olympics only makes those around me miserable. Dawes' post-Olympic life has been specifically engineered to avoid the pitfalls people face after ultra-high achievement. She has a good marriage, kids, and is very serious about her Catholic faith. She doesn't live in the past. Many other stars have not fared so well. The fact that we can't store up our glories and enjoy them when they are long past gets to the problem of dissatisfaction, a problem we will confront later in this book. Humans simply aren't wired to enjoy an achievement long past. It is as if we are on a moving treadmill. Satisfaction from success lasts but an instant. We can't stop and enjoy it. If we do, we zip off the back of the treadmill and wipe out. So we run and run, hoping that the next success, greater than the last, will bring the enduring satisfaction we crave. The decline problem is a double whammy, then. We need ever greater success to avoid dissatisfaction, yet our abilities to stay even are declining. No, actually it's a triple whammy, because as we try to stay even, we wind up in patterns of addictive behavior, such as workaholism, which puts strivers into unhealthy relationship patterns at the cost of deep connection to spouses, children, and friends. By the time the wipeout occurs, there's no one there to help us get up and dust off. That leads many achievers into a vicious cycle. Terrified of decline, dissatisfied with victories that come less and less frequently, hooked on the successes that are increasingly of the past, and isolated from others. And it's not as if the world is overflowing with resources to help you. No one feels sorry for a successful person. The suffering of a striver with a comfortable life invokes the image of the world's smallest violin. And yet, it's real. Where we go from here? Here's the bottom line, fellow striver. When it comes to the enviable skills that you worked so hard to attain and that made you successful in your field, you can expect significant decline to come as soon as your 30s or as late as your early 50s. That's the deal, and it's not fun. Sorry. So what are you going to do about it? There are really only three doors you can go through here. Number one, you can deny the facts and rage against decline, setting yourself up for frustration and disappointment. Number two, you can shrug and give in to decline and experience your aging as an unavoidable tragedy. Or number three, you can accept that what got you to this point won't work to get you into the future, that you need to build some new strengths and skills. If you choose door number three, congratulations. There's a bright future ahead, but it requires a bunch of new skills and a new way of thinking. Chapter 2, The Second Curve. Decline is unavoidable, period. But aging isn't all bad news, and I'm not talking about grandkids in a condo in Sarasota, although that's got to be nice too. In fact, there are some specific ways in which we naturally get smarter and more skillful. The trick to improving as we age is to understand, develop, and practice these new strengths. If you can, and I'm going to show you how, don't worry, you can transform decline into incredible new success. Did you ever notice that as people get old, they almost never become less articulate? They tend to have a richer vocabulary than they did earlier in life. This leads to a number of abilities. They're better Scrabble players, for example, and can do quite well in foreign languages, not in getting the accent perfect, but in building vocabulary and understanding grammar. Studies bear out these observations. People maintain and grow their vocabulary in their native languages and foreign languages all the way to the end of life. Similarly, you may notice that with age, people are better at combining and utilizing complex ideas. In other words, they may not be able to come up with shiny new inventions or solve problems quickly like in the old days, but they get much better at using the concepts they know and expressing them to others. They also get better at interpreting the ideas that others have, sometimes even to the people who came up with them. I have found this in my life. I lived in Spain in my youth and have gone back and forth to Barcelona for more than 30 years. There are two languages in Barcelona, Spanish and Catalan, which I spoke well when I lived there, but which got a little rusty when I was living in the United States. Weirdly, I found that my ability in both improved starting around age 50 and now is better than it was even when I lived there. Similarly, as a social scientist, I am better at telling a story from data than I was earlier in my career. While I doubt I could write the scholarly papers I once did, sometimes I have trouble understanding the math in my own research from 20 years ago, I can tell you how insights relate to one another and how to apply them in your life. Hence, I'm writing this book and not an impenetrable mathematical academic article. I invented ideas early on. I synthesize ideas, mine and others, now. These abilities that appear later in life favor some specific professions. For example, theoretical mathematicians tend to peak and decline early, just as Simonton's data predict. But applied mathematicians, who use mathematics to, for example, solve actual problems in business, peak much later because they specialize in combining and using ideas that already exist, a skill that favors older people. Or take historians, the quintessential assemblers of existing facts and ideas. Weirdly, they fall way out of the typical range for decline, peaking 39.7 years after career inception on average. Think what this implies. Say you intend to pursue a career as a professional historian and finish your PhD at 32. The bad news is that in your 50s, you're still pretty wet behind the ears. But here's the good news. At age 72, you still have half your work to go. Better take care of your health so you can write your best books into your 80s. If you take these facts as being random, you get very little actionable strategy for life, beyond perhaps becoming a competitive Scrabble player or working on a PhD in history. It isn't random, however, not at all. In the late 1960s, a British psychologist named Raymond Cattell set about finding an explanation for why all this happens. He found the answer, and that answer can defeat the striver's curse and change your life. Two intelligences. In 1971, Cattell published a book entitled Abilities, Their Structure, Growth, and Action. In it, he posited that there were two types of intelligence that people possess, but at greater abundance at different points in life. The first is fluid intelligence, which Cattell defined as the ability to reason, think flexibly, and solve novel problems. It is what we commonly think of as raw smarts, and researchers find that it is associated with both reading and mathematical ability. Innovators typically have an abundance of fluid intelligence. Cattell, who specialized in intelligence testing, observed that it was highest relatively early in adulthood and diminished rapidly starting in one's 30s and 40s. Based on this finding, Cattell believed younger people are naturally the best innovators in raw, new ideas. If he were alive today, he died in 1998 at the ripe old age of 92, he would read what I've written up to this point and say right away that the professional decline I've been talking about, the initial abilities that fade all too early, comes from the fluid intelligence that virtually all hardworking, successful people rely on early in their careers. If you've experienced professional success in the early part of your career and your job involved new ideas or solving hard problems, most people listening to this book, I would bet, you have fluid intelligence, plus your hard work, maybe your parents, and good luck to thank for it. The young killers in almost every modern industry rely on fluid intelligence. They learn quickly, focus hard on what matters, and devise solutions. Unfortunately, as we've seen in abundant detail, you generally can't maintain this as you age, which, once again, might well be why you're listening to this book. That's not the end of the story, however, and this is where Cattell's work matters. Fluid intelligence isn't the only kind. There's also crystallized intelligence. This is defined as the ability to use a stock of knowledge learned in the past. Think once again about the metaphor of a vast library. But this time, instead of regretting how slow the librarian is, marvel at the size of the book collection your librarian is wandering around in, and the fact that he knows where to find a book, even if it takes him a while. Crystallized intelligence, relying as it does on a stock of knowledge, tends to increase with age through one's 40s, 50s, and 60s, and does not diminish until quite late in life, if at all. Cattell himself described the two intelligences in this way. Fluid intelligence is conceptualized as the decontextualized ability to solve abstract problems, while crystallized intelligence represents a person's knowledge gained during life by acculturation and learning. Translation: when you're young, you have raw smarts. When you're old, you have wisdom. When you're young, you can generate lots of facts. When you're old, you know what they mean and how to use them. Let's break things down a bit. Cattell is telling us that the success curve in Simonton's model from the last chapter is, for all intents and purposes, the fluid intelligence curve, which increases to one's mid-30s or so and then declines to the 40s and 50s. Meanwhile, there's another curve lurking behind it, the crystallized intelligence curve, that is increasing through middle and late adulthood. Simonton's success curve, the fluid intelligence curve, peaks in early to middle age. But while it is declining, the crystallized intelligence curve is slowly rising, peaking, and staying high years and decades after the fluid intelligence curve has fallen. This is a big finding for you and me. Huge, actually. It says that if your career relies solely on fluid intelligence, it's true that you will peak and decline pretty early. But if your career requires crystallized intelligence, or if you can repurpose your professional life to rely more on crystallized intelligence, your peak will come later, but your decline will happen much, much later, if ever. And if you can go from one type to the other, well, then you've cracked the code. What about the career curves described earlier? In some cases, such as tech entrepreneurs, the career curve is effectively the same as that of fluid intelligence, which is why the fade happens at such a young age. Other fields, however, require an admixture of the two types of intelligence, placing the career high point somewhat later. And in some careers that rely almost entirely on a large mental library and ability to use it, the peak happens very late in life. Almost without fail, you will notice the decline in the fluid intelligence portion. However, there always exists the ability to redesign your career less on innovation and more on instruction as the years pass, thus playing to your strengths with age. Some careers make this easier than others. The study of history, for example, is one career that requires huge stocks of knowledge and the wisdom to synthesize it. It is an almost pure crystallized intelligence field. But there are other professions that are more common than being a historian. Notably, there's teaching, which once again requires verbal skill and a gift for explaining large amounts of accumulated information. No wonder this field favors the old over the young. A recent study in the Chronicle of Higher Education showed that the oldest college professors tended to have the best teaching evaluations within departments. They found this especially in the humanities, where professors got their lowest ratings early in their careers and improved through their 60s and 70s. A note to college students listening to this book: enroll in the classes of the oldest professors. This late-in-life success probably partially explains the professional longevity of college professors, three-quarters of whom plan to retire after age 65, while the average retirement age in America is 62. I remember one day in my first year at a graduate school as an assistant professor, I struck up a conversation with a colleague in his late 60s. I asked him if he would ever consider retiring. He laughed and told me he was more likely to leave his office horizontally than vertically. Perhaps the dean would have chuckled ruefully at this comment. College administrators often complain that there is a noticeable drop-off in research productivity, which depends on fluid intelligence, especially for analytical work, among tenured faculty in the last decades of their careers. Older professors take up faculty lines that could otherwise be used to hire young scholars hungry to develop their research agendas and who are overflowing with fluid intelligence. But therein lies an opportunity. The question is not how to stimulate older faculty to write more complicated academic journal articles. It is how to adjust their work portfolio toward teaching without loss of professional status. The idea of moving to instruction later in life is a theme one finds in the great wisdom literatures from east to west. Just as one uses a burning candle to light others with, says the elderly archery teacher in Eugen Herigel's famous book Zen and the Art of Archery, so the teacher transfers the spirit of the right art from heart to heart that it may be illumined. Or consider the wisdom of the first century BC Roman statesman, lawyer, scholar, and philosopher, Marcus Tullius Cicero. Cicero is the most important voice from that period that still exists today. Three quarters of the surviving Latin literature from Cicero's lifetime was written by him. In his last year of life, he wrote an open letter to his son on the responsibilities of an upright person, entitled De Officiis. Much of it concerns the duties of a young person, but he also expounds on the vocation in the second half of life. The old should, it seems, have their physical labors reduced. Their mental activities should be actually increased. They should endeavor, too, by means of their counsel and practical wisdom, to be of as much service as possible to their friends and to the young, and above all, to the state. Cicero believed three things about older age. First, that it should be dedicated to service, not goofing off. Second, our greatest gift later in life is wisdom, in which learning and thought create a worldview that can enrich others. Third, our natural ability at this point is counsel, mentoring, advising, and teaching others in a way that does not amass worldly rewards of money, power, or prestige. Cicero didn't just give good advice, by the way. He lived it and died practicing it. He lived in a dangerous time for public intellectuals. We fret about cancel culture today. Cicero was assassinated at the age of 63 for his less than politically correct ideas, specifically his criticism of Mark Antony after the murder of Julius Caesar. Running for his life due to his political views, he was captured by a Roman centurion and was about to be put to death. The pinnacle of crystallized intelligence, he was a teacher with his dying breath. There is nothing proper about what you are doing, soldier, Cicero schooled the centurion, but do try to kill me properly. The teaching gift to crystallized intelligence was on my mind a couple of years ago when I gave a speech to the employees of a prominent Silicon Valley tech firm. After my remarks, a young man in the audience asked me to weigh in on the diversity problem in his industry. He was referring to the lack of racial minorities and women in the engineering profession, and I was happy to address that point. But then I took the opportunity to ask whether anyone in his youth-dominated business ever thought about age diversity. "Do you have enough old people working here?" I asked. His response was instructive. "You mean people over 30? Punk." The point is not to find jobs for the elderly. It's to glean the wisdom and experience from people who've seen a lot, have already made every stupid mistake in the book, and can teach the younger folks before they make avoidable errors. Over the last few years, the youth-dominated firms in the tech sector have been battered by scandals and plummeting public admiration. Where once they were venerated as the future of capitalism, today people often see their products as harmful and their leaders as selfish and childish. Older executives in other industries just shake their heads at the seemingly obvious mistakes the young tech entrepreneurs are making. So what do the young hotshots need? Old people on product teams, old people in marketing, and old people in the C-suite. They need not just whiz-bang ideas, but actual wisdom that only comes with years in the school of hard knocks. The joys of the second curve. The existence of the second curve is great news for all of us. First, we now have an explanation for the typical drop-off in abilities in one's 40s or 50s. In other words, if you're my age or older, it isn't just you. Second, there's a second wave to ride to success that favors people who are older. Third, by most estimations, what you get in this second wave is more valuable, if less lucrative and prestigious, than what you get in the first. After all, as the saying goes, knowledge is knowing that a tomato is fruit. Wisdom is knowing not to put it in a fruit salad. Or, more biblically, teach us to number our days, that we may gain a heart of wisdom. If you're experiencing a decline in fluid intelligence, and if you're my age, you are, it doesn't mean you're washed up. It means it's time to jump off the fluid intelligence curve and onto the crystallized intelligence curve. Those who fight against time are trying to bend the old curve instead of getting onto the new one. But it's almost impossible to bend, which is why people are so frustrated and usually unsuccessful. So why do people try over and over again? Two reasons. First, they're not aware that their first curve naturally bends down. They think something's wrong with them. And second, they don't know that another curve exists that will take them to a new kind of success. And even if they do suspect there's another curve out there, it can be hard and scary to make the jump. It requires courage and fortitude to make changes in our lives and careers, to become more of a teacher, whatever that means in one specific field. Not everybody wants to do that. Many refuse. But for those who make the jump, the reward is almost always enormous. In interviewing people for this book, I found that invariably, the people who are happiest and most satisfied in their 50s, 60s, and 70s are those who made this leap. Here are a couple of examples, starting with a 58-year-old male actuary. Here's what he told me. "I am at the point in my career where I'm looking forward to retirement, not as a chance to stop working, but more as a chance to work on other things that I am finding have become very important to me. In addition to my day job, I am teaching financial math one evening a week to graduate students. I find this very rewarding as I bring the insights of my long career to these young, aspiring minds. They have a thirst for learning, and I enjoy meeting them and helping them see the insights beyond the textbooks." A female television journalist told me something similar after retiring to a teaching job at a small college. "I feel lucky to be inside academia, which seems to value older people. I'm practically young compared to some of the faculty I work with, and they are fascinating, brilliant folks. That's been one of the most wonderful differences between TV news and this. Adults are valued, hold leadership roles, and their knowledge is appreciated. Because TV news relies on innovation, this is not possible." Be like Bach. In the last chapter, I gave some examples of prominent historical strivers. Charles Darwin, Linus Pauling, who either didn't know there was a second curve or simply couldn't make the jump. There are other examples from history of people who have done it spectacularly, however. My favorite example of involuntary decline, followed by the joys of finding the second curve, comes from the great composer Johann Sebastian Bach. Born in 1685 to a long line of prominent musicians in central Germany, J.S. Bach quickly distinguished himself as a unique musical genius. In his lifetime, he published more than 1,000 compositions for all the available instrumentations of his day. The greatest cantatas for orchestra and chorus ever written seemed to fall off his pen by the dozens. His concerti are compositionally perfect. His piano works, simple and elegant. Bach is my favorite composer. I love his music so much that as a kid, I pointed out to people with pride that Bach, translated into English, is the surname Brook, or in its much more common form, Brooks. Coincidence? I am hardly unique in my love for Bach, though. The great 20th century Spanish cellist Pablo Casals, who brought Bach's suites for solo cello to a worldwide audience, said this of his musical hero: "To strip human nature until its divine attributes are made clear, to inform ordinary activities with spiritual fervor, to give wings of eternity to that which is most ephemeral, to make divine things human and human things divine, such is Bach, the greatest and purest moment in music of all time." Or, as the composer Robert Schumann put it, music owes as much to Bach as religion to its founder. I'm not sure I'd go so far as Schumann, comparing Bach to Jesus, but really, when you finish this chapter, go listen to his St. Matthew Passion, or Mass in B minor, the piece I was listening to when I wrote these words. You'll understand why some call him the fifth evangelist. Bach's prodigious output wasn't limited to music, by the way. He fathered 20 children, 7 by his beloved first wife, Maria Barbara, who tragically died at 35, 13 more with his second wife, Anna Magdalena. Only 10 of Bach's children lived to adulthood, but these included 4 composers who went on to attain significant fame in their own right. The greatest of these was Carl Philipp Emanuel, known as CPE to the generations that followed. J.S. Bach's musical vernacular was the High Baroque. Early in his career, he was considered by many to be the finest composer in this style ever to have lived. Commissions rolled in. Royalty sought him out, specifically Prince Leopold of Anhalt-Köthen. Young composers emulated his style. He lived in increasing prominence with his large, beloved family. But his fame and glory didn't last, in no small part because his career was overtaken by musical events ushered in by a young up-and-comer who kicked him out of the limelight by rendering the High Baroque as obsolete as disco. That usurper was none other than J.S.'s own son, C.P.E. Early on, C.P.E. showed the same musical gifts his father had. As he developed, he mastered the Baroque idiom, but was more fascinated by the newfangled classical style of music that everyone wanted to hear. CPE's fame rose with the popularity of the classical style. Meanwhile, Baroque music became regarded as old-fashioned and stuffy, along with the composers, including J.S., who would not or could not write in the new style. And just like that, CPE displaced J.S. as the family's musical celebrity. For the last decades of J.S.'s life, and a century afterward, CPE was considered the greatest of the Bachs. Joseph Haydn and Ludwig van Beethoven admired CPE and collected his music. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart himself said, "Bach is the father, we are the children," referring to CPE, not J.S. J.S. Bach could easily have become embittered like Darwin, feeling left behind by the musical cognoscenti after a career at the forefront. Instead, he took pride in his son's originality and redesigned his own life, moving from musical innovator to master teacher. He spent the last 10 years of his life working on, among other projects, Die Kunst der Fuge, The Art of Fugue, a collection of fugues and canons based on a single theme intended to teach the compositional techniques of the Baroque. The Art of Fugue was written as a kind of textbook. 100 years after Bach's death, it was rediscovered and began to be performed in public. Today, it is common to hear it in concerts. Imagine a textbook so beautiful that it is considered a work of literature or even poetry. That's the greatness of J.S. Bach. But just as impressive a feat as this was his personal resiliency. He experienced professional decline as a musical innovator. Far from frustration and depression, he finished out his life as a happy father and reinvented himself as a teacher. J.S. Bach died working on his master text, literally. The manuscript for his Contrapuntus 14 from the Art of Fugue stops mid-measure. None other than CPE added these words some years later.